Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Welcome back to Circles of Change in our final segment today. It's a real pleasure to have a noted psychologist and author with us, Dr. Pavel Samov. Pavel, how are you today?
I'm great, thank you.
Terrific. Well, we've got a call to Pittsburgh, so let me fill in the blanks here before Pavel and I start speaking. He's an expert on the many ways that mindfulness and meditation can improve our day-to-day lives. A licensed psychologist from Pittsburgh area, as I mentioned, he's respected for successfully guiding patients in recovery struggling with substance abuse through mindfulness-based interventions. An immigrant from Russia at the age of 21, Pavel became a U.S. citizen in 1996. He received his Ph.D. in counseling psychology from the State University of New York at their Buffalo location in 2000. He's the author of three books, Eating the Moment, subtitled 141 Mindful Practices to Overcome Overeating One Meal at a Time. His second book is Present Perfect, a mindfulness approach to letting go of perfectionism and the need for control, which actually was recently translated into the Dutch language. And then his most recent book that we're going to focus on today, The Lotus Effect, Shedding Suffering and Rediscovering Your Essential Self. Pavel also offers workshops and teleseminars in addition to a library of complimentary articles that are all posted on his site at www.drsomov.com. So three in a row, new books. I bet that keeps you busy amongst your practice as well.
It certainly does.
That's great. Has it opened up a lot of doors for new connections with people in the process for you?
Yes, there's been a lot of very enjoyable correspondence with my readers and with some colleagues.
That's a great way to continue the roll-on effect. The metaphor of the lotus, your book, The Lotus Effect, I think we could probably start there as an easy launch for our conversation. Why that flower, or what's the connectivity to the topic within your book?
Okay. As you know, Zara, lotus has been a long-standing symbol of enlightenment in the East, and the rationale for that is that it's certainly a beautiful flower, but it's not just beautiful, it's also a very smart flower. It's got a kind of natural Raynex coating on it, and the result is that nothing sticks to it. So mm-hmm. even though it starts out in a very murky, kind of muddy, humble circumstance at the bottom of the ponds, it's able to grow to its fullest blossom. It makes it to the surface of the ponds and dazzles us with its beauty, and partially because it metaphorically is capable of self-cleaning. So the lotus effect is the metaphor for organizing this book. The idea behind the psychological lotus effect is to cultivate resilient identity, the kind of identity that can help you survive any change in circumstance, be it a job loss or a relationship loss, without the loss of self.
Yeah, and that's of course the gotcha, is that without the loss of self that you want to bring home to us in this book. That aspect of resiliency, I think that'd probably be a good word for you also to characterize for us. I think some people, that engenders this thought of, you know, powerful strength, impenetrable. But I think you would also say it also means this, it's almost another softness side, though. It's an anchoring side of us.
It certainly is. I guess my favorite way of thinking of that is self-knowledge. Essentially, if we were to really strip the book down to its most basic psychological advice, then it's very simple. The idea is to know yourself to minimize suffering. When we don't know what we are, we get caught up in a variety of false selves, and any time those get wounded, we end up protecting them and we compound our suffering. So the idea here is to discover that nonverbal, experiential, immediate, direct sense of self, that sameness or self-sameness that is always there no matter what your life is about. And once you learn how to get to that place, once you learn how to access that sense of self, that self-knowledge allows you to roll better. It allows you to feel less easily wounded. You still get wounded, of course. You still get muddied up and dirtied up by the process of life, but you shed suffering a little faster. So the idea here is to provide a kind of catalyst for coping
Yeah. Now, I liked what you said there, this idea of minimizing suffering. Your point being is that really it is the human condition that we have to go through those ebbs and tides, right?
Certainly. Life is movement. Movement comes with friction. We're gonna burn up in the process. Metabolism itself is a slow burn. So suffering is inevitable, and the idea here is to simply learn how to shed it faster, how to cope better and more effectively. And once again, the point of the book is that once you know yourself, as opposed to once you have a favorite description of yourself, mm-hmm. you're able to do that much more effectively. You become a kind of Teflon mind, if you wish.
A Teflon mind, I like that. You know, right at the beginning of your book, Pavel, you talk about this identity detoxifying, right? I mean, shedding these other identities. My question, though, is as we go through our life, many of our identities, though, do serve us very, very well, don't they?
Certainly, yeah. They're absolutely useful. Ego is a business card that we use. It's part of the transaction with the world. But the idea is to realize that ego is just an informational avatar. It's just something that represents us, but the description isn't that which it describes. We're not our representations. So actually, I lost track of your question.
Well, my point was, is this idea of to go detoxed the identities that may not be serving us well.
Yes.
Is that how can you parse out, though, the ones that don't serve you well to the ones that are really invaluable, whether it be for coping with life's changes or giving us resilience as we strive from some new level of success, whether that be success in the job or success as a new parent? I mean, how would you know the difference?
Well, actually, the path that I offer in the book is a total identity strip down. We're not any of our identities, no matter how useful or useless they are. For example, you introduced me to your listeners as a psychologist, and
right.
Of course I'm not. I'm not what I do. Psychologist is a title. It's a role that I play. It's a path of livelihood. But I'm not what I do. I'm not how I earn my living. I'm not my credentials. I'm not my professional accoutrements. So when you begin to go through this kind of process and you realize that you're not your roles, you're not other people's thoughts about you, you're not your own thoughts about you, you're not your circumstance, you become essentially liberated each and every time you strip away one of these layers of identity, however useful or useless they are. You experience yourself in an altogether different manner. You experience yourself as a kind of immutable, invulnerable, resilient essence that morphs and changes shape and form, but at core and fundamentally remains the same.
Now, but some people, I would think that this idea of this journey to stripping away things, though, aren't we more afraid that we're going to find something that's empty without meaning?
Exactly. And I spent the second part of the book challenging this apparent nihilism. One of the problems with Buddhist self-help literature is that it tends to lead the readers to the conclusion that there is absolutely no self whatsoever, that you're a complete and total emptiness and nothing. And certainly that's not the case. You exist, I exist. We just don't exist in the manner that we can describe. So when you strip away everything that you can describe, you end up with something that is very experientially tangible, and yet it's beyond words. So we're not a nothing. We're just something that is beyond description.
Ooh, that's a pretty tricky one. You know, I can relate this if I can offer an analogy, and perhaps you can give us some examples as to how you've helped people through the journey of applying this lotus effect. But it comes to mind the number of individuals I've assisted that have made the decision to retire from being whatever it is that they did. I'll use some of your words. You know, a gentleman that was a highly successful executive search professional, and he decided, you know, prepare for retirement and start his encore of his life. And he just very silently described that those first few months of not being able to answer the question when they were in cocktail parties, and what is it that you do? And for him to say, well, I'm not of this or not of that, but what then am I? And he says for him that was the biggest kind of reemergence from that decision to retire, was that now he can very comfortably say, I'm Fred. Plain and simple, I'm Fred.
Yeah, that's a great example, and this is essentially the path that I would take with a similar presentation. Oftentimes what I do with my clients is that I help them differentiate between symbolic threats an actual tangible physical threats. The curious thing is that we've never been safer as a species. We pretty much don't have any natural predators left, and yet we're hypervigilant, and we're always on guard, and we're protecting our informational avatars. So once you introduce this distinction that we're not our descriptions, a lot of the psychological vulnerability falls away. So, for example, somebody calls you a jerk, you realize that you're not that person's description of you. You're not their image of you. You're not even your own image of yourself. You're not your favorite self-description. So, the basic process here is to get it in your bones once and for all that you're not the information. You're that which is in the process of formation. You're not the particular form of life. You're life itself, the essence, not the form. So, for example, recently I was working with a couple, and they couldn't quite begin the process of reconciliation until they could define what they were to each other. They really got hung up on the idea of whether they were still, you know, exes or boyfriends and girlfriends. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to be an unusual place for me to jump in with this whole idea of Lotus Effect. But once we did that, once we realized that the self-descriptions are irrelevant, what's relevant in their particular case was the emotional interplay. Once they let go of the idea of defining themselves, they were able to proceed with the process, and they're still working on it. So the basic idea here is to go beyond words, to realize that we're not the descriptions that we use. You know, I can describe a chair in great detail, but can I sit in the description of the chair? Of course I cannot. By the same token, I can describe myself, but am I my own description? Of course not.
Well, you know, your the first part, actually, the second part of your book really uses also that metaphor of a mirror.
Yes.
You know, that we have this breaking away from the physical mirror, social mirror, mirror of action, mirror of context, time, and so on. You know, my sense of that use of that word mirror, though, is that still a reflected self. You know, it may not be the real self because there's still light affecting that vision.
Well, in some ways, we are a mirror, and in some ways, we're not. This is where the discussion becomes very nuanced and potentially very confusing, although I always welcome confusion. Confusion is an opportunity to let go of the known categories. Most of what we tend to think of ourselves is that we are the reflection in the mirror. We are what we see, as opposed to the seer.
Got it.
So when I introspect, I see something, right? I have some kind of image of myself, or I stumble upon a blank spot in my mind and I think that I'm that blankness, and yet that blankness is just another reflection of sorts. So on some level, we tend to have this habit of confusing ourselves with the reflections in the mirror. On the other hand, we read about, you know, this whole Buddhist folklore of mirror mind, and we internalize this expectation that we should strive for being a mirror as opposed to confusing ourselves with a reflection in the mirror. And yet, you know, when you put it all together, and this is probably going to be completely confusing to your readers because I'm not really doing a whole lot of justice to this on the fly, but there is no reflection without a mirror, and as long as there is a mirror, there is some kind of reflection on it. So the reflection is the mirror, but at the same time, reflection isn't the mirror. Reflection comes and goes, the mirror remains. And yet, as long as there is a mirror, there is some kind of reflection on it. So, in a sense, what we're dealing with here is the dead end of language.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. It really is the dead end in language. And, in fact, in a society that is so spun up about branding and catchphrases and taglines and so on, that we many times lose track of what's at the core.
Exactly.
And it's all the icing that we put everything over everything.
Yes. It helps to ask yourself at least once in life, what is language for? Language is designed to describe reality. But how does it do so? You know, language is essentially a collection of symbols, and each and every symbol zooms in on a certain aspect of reality, and in so doing, it artificially cuts it off from the rest of what is. And yet the reality is whole. It's one. It's not cut up into the elements that our words pertain to. So the whole problem of using words and self-description and building your psychological health on the basis of your favorite self-description is that all of that is fundamentally is transient, fleeting, and incomplete. So once again, the idea here is to first let go of all these false selves, and then to learn how to non-verbally and experientially access that state of amness.
So the non-verbally, I can get that one, because
yes.
That's one of really dwelling from within and prayer, meditation, peace. But tell me the experientially part of that. You're saying injecting perhaps more play, more free thinking, more one side of the brain versus the other side of the brain?
Not necessarily. I think it's actually it's far simpler than that.
Okay.
You ask yourself, what am I? And anything that your mind spits out in response, you disidentify from, and what's left is you. So basically, the idea here is not to answer the question, really.
Yeah, exactly.
But
yeah.
To pose it in the first place. The book leads you up to this place, to this precipice of words. And what happens afterwards is just the free flow and the free flight of amness. One of my favorite exercises, few of my clients do that, but I've certainly tried it with myself, is to record the question, who am I? And repeat it several times. So ask, have a recording, who am I? Wait 30 seconds, ask that question again. Do it for about 10 minutes. And then listen to the recording and notice that each and every time you hear the question, your mind spits out some kind of answer. And as soon as your mind does that, recognize yourself as separate from that thought that is passing through you. You're not that thought of self-description, however seemingly accurate it might be. For example, you might say, well, I am me. You know, it's kind of tautological statement. How can I be wrong with that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously, you're not the thought, I am me, because you've had other thoughts, and those thoughts came and went. So obviously, there's never been a thought that didn't pass away, including this one.
That's right.
And
interesting approach. Now, some of in your earlier books, of course, the being present, the present perfect, about, you know, eschewing perfectionism. And
yep.
Then even your first book, that you do a lot of work with people who are trying to get beyond eating compulsions, I take it. Were these three books kind of a logical step from one to the next?
Yeah, in fact, each and every book has a paragraph that sets up the next book.
It sets up the next book.
I didn't exactly plan it as such, but it kind of serendipitously worked out that way.
Mm-hmm. The fact that you have yourself focused your practice and your learnings and that which you share around the whole mindfulness techniques, and given you, of course, your Russian background as well, this is much more Eastern philosophy. Were these learnings and practices you've been involved in since a youth, or was it something you were exposed to later in life?
Well, my dad was a writer in the Soviet Union. He was a very curious guy. He managed to be relatively successful, albeit poor because of his drinking problems, without ever having to join the Communist Party. So he was a total libertarian at heart. He was a free thinker. And I remember learning some yoga ideas, and I'm talking about Raja Yoga, right. Not the body yoga, but the mind yoga, from him when I was still in my early teens, and him talking about quantum mechanics and the epistemological issues of what is knowledge and what is illusion. So he sort of primed my appetite for those kinds of things, but I didn't really seriously dive into all of this until probably mid-90s, and then I just I found a lot of freedom.
I was going to say you tumbled head over heels.
Yeah.
Do you think it was any series of particular events that tumbled you in that direction?
Well, you know, I stumbled upon one of these little annoying Zen books that is full of anecdotes that seemingly don't make sense, and I decided to mock that process. I wrote a little book called Egg Drop Soup for the Mind, in which I decided to be the rascal sage. I decided to conjure up a whole bunch of little Zen vignettes that break the patterns and confuse the mind and set you up for some kind of clarity. And while I was mocking the style, I inadvertently became indoctrinated in that school of thought. So I started out by just being a kind of literary hooligan for my own friends. And then I saw the sturdiness of the platform.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel that it isn't just in your writing, obviously, but you're working with clients over the years, that you have found these techniques and these approaches then all that more sustainable to help them really change and transform?
Yes. In a sense, and maybe this is a useful distinction to make on air, mindfulness is just metacognitive distancing. You know, this whole idea of vipassana and mindfulness is just the Eastern analog of what in the West we refer to as metacognitive distancing. It's just a basic mode of engagement. We're not generally trained to notice those kinds of things. We're not taught to pay attention to the transience and the impermanence of the objects of consciousness that pass through us. But there is really no mystery in this. I look at Buddhism and Jainism and Hinduism, not necessarily as theosophies or religions, but as the original schools of psychotherapy. And in fact, the historical Buddha positioned himself as a kind of medicine man, the shaman of the mind, you know, the healer of suffering.
Of course.
So all of that very neatly fits in with our modern-day professional mental health aspirations, mm-hmm. particularly in the matters of craving control and psychological independence.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned that, you know, one book led to the next, which led to the next, and I noted out on your website, which for our listeners, again, is drsomov, drsomov.com, that you've got two projects in the making. Are they thus a logical step from those first three?
Somewhat. The next book is essentially a mindfulness-based protocol for smoking cessation, and the idea behind that project is to help people recognize that they haven't been wasting their health while smoking. In fact, what they've been doing is essentially developing an excellent habit of breath-focused meditation, and what the book does is that it allows you to gradually
to shift it, yeah,
kick the tobacco and keep the habit of breathing mindfully. And the project that follows is more of a think book on the idea of what a meal is. I have this curious idea that at some point as a civilization it would be useful for us to learn from the plants how to generate fuel without killing our fellow creatures. So there has been some thinking done about cultivating photosynthesis among humans and essentially learning from our fellow plants.
Absolutely. In fact, I could, this is a whole nother show, so I'm going to call you back. We're going to talk about that when that book's available. But so many people that are involved in physical strength training indeed position that whole thought that you are creating fuel by that which you consume. Well, Pavel Samov, thank you so much for contributing to our show again and for our listeners. His latest book is The Lotus Effect, Shedding Suffering and Rediscovering Your Essential Self. You can learn more about his work at www.drsomov.com. Thank you so much and have a great balance of the day.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, 877-544-2580.